When you open up one of those massive financial models, it is incredibly easy to just be totally intimidated by it.
Oh, absolutely. It's overwhelming.
Right. You stare at those interlocking sheets, the complex macros, and there's this final valuation sitting there at the bottom with like two decimal points of precision. And it feels like you're looking at pure objective physics.
Yeah, it really
It
does.
feels like if you just turn the crank on the math, the absolute truth of what an asset is worth will just magically materialize for you.
Well, I mean, we desperately want investing to be a hard science, right? We
Yeah.
look for some kind of formula that just eliminates uncertainty.
Yeah, magic bullet.
Exactly, which is why that whole spreadsheet aesthetic is so comforting to us. But the source material for today's deep dive, this really fascinating chapter from the AI Native Investor series, it argues that the spreadsheet is basically masking a huge reality. You're actually just looking at a highly structured piece of fiction.
A story in disguise.
Precisely. And our mission today is to figure out why these formulas lie to us, how to spot those hidden narratives, and how you can use AI agents to do all that heavy mathematical lifting so you can just focus on the storytelling.
I love that. And to see just how true that is, we don't even need to look at a theoretical model, right? We can look at a real, very famous historical example from the sources. January 2014 with Uber.
Oh, yeah, the Uber debate.
You had Aswak Dimadaran, who is arguably, the most respected valuation expert on the planet, publishing his deep dive on Uber. He ran the numbers, built the whole model, and concluded the company was worth roughly $5.9 billion.
Which was a massive number at the time, but then a few months later, Bill Gurley comes along.
Right, the legendary venture capitalist.
Right, and he actually bashed Uber. He published this detailed rebuttal to Damodaran. And the crazy part is, Gurley looked at the exact same public data, utilized the exact same discounted cash flow methodology, the same DCF model, and argued the company was worth $25
Right,
billion.
or potentially even much more, right?
Yeah, potentially much more. And here's the kicker. Neither of them made an arithmetic error.
Wow.
The underlying math in both of their models was completely flawless.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because how can two brilliant financial minds look at the exact same numbers, use the exact same math, and get an answer that is $20 billion apart?
Because the mass isn't the variable. The variable has to be the underlying narrative.
Right.
See, Damodaran's story was that he was valuing a black car service that was competing for the existing taxi market.
Which is a big market, sure.
It is, but it has a hard quantifiable ceiling. You know exactly how many people take taxis. Gurley, on the other hand, his story was that he was valuing a logistics network that would entirely replace the concept of urban car ownership altogether.
Ah, so a completely unbounded market.
Exactly. The models were simply translating those two competing worldviews into a numerical format. Damodaran's bounded market story dictated a certain revenue ceiling, which then trickled down into his growth rates.
And Gurley's story dictated this totally different exponential growth trajectory.
Yeah. So the numbers didn't resolve their disagreement. The numbers were the disagreement. Valuation is not a calculation, it's just a story wrapped in numbers.
So if the entire output is dictated by the narrative, I mean, it really exposes the mechanical flaws in the traditional tools we all use.
It really does.
Like, let's look at the three main approaches investors actually use, starting with the classic intrinsic valuation,
Right.
the DCF. We all know the theory, right? You project the future cash flows and discount them back to today.
Which is fine for stable companies.
Right. But when you apply that to, say, an early stage pre-revenue biotech firm, the math actually works against you.
Because of the compounding nature of uncertainty,
Yes, exactly.
when you forecast cash flows 10 years out for a company that hasn't even established product market fit, every single assumption exponentially compounds on the last one.
You aren't calculating value at that point.
No, you are mathematically amplifying your own optimism. The model might spit out a value of, I don't know, $147.32 per share,
Yeah.
but that precision is entirely fabricated.
It's a lie.
A complete lie. The output is exactly as uncertain as your most speculative input.
Which is why I think people often look for harder floors,
Yeah.
like asset-based valuation. You just look at the balance sheet, subtract the liabilities, and see what the physical stuff is actually worth.
And that works beautifully if you're like liquidating a textile mill in 1950.
Right, or valuing a real estate holding trust or something.
Exactly. But apply that to a modern software monopoly and the logic just collapses. I mean, if you value Google or Meta based on their physical servers and corporate campuses,
You're missing, what, 95% of the enterprise value?
at least. their true assets are network effects, intellectual property, user habituation, and those just don't sit on a balance sheet in a way that traditional accounting can capture.
So because those two methods have issues, we naturally default to relative valuation.
The multiple.
Right, the multiples. Mm-hmm. EV to EBITDA, PE ratios, price to sales. But using relative multiples always strikes me as, well, isn't it just like copying your neighbor's test answers?
That's a great way to put it.
If your neighbor hasn't studied and is failing the test, copying their answers just ensures you fail together.
Oh, absolutely. And the late 90s dot-com bubble is the perfect illustration of how dangerous that relative logic can be. The sources bring up Cisco in 1999.
Oh, man.
Cisco.
Yeah. It was trading at roughly 120 times its earnings. By any historical standard, that multiple is mathematically unjustifiable.
It's insane.
Totally insane. But analysts at the time were issuing strong buy recommendations. They were arguing the stock was actually an incredible bargain.
Because they were comparing it to its peers, right?
Yeah.
Intel or Microsoft, who were trading at like 150 times earnings.
Exactly. The relative comparison was technically accurate. Cisco is cheaper than Microsoft. But it completely ignored the fact that the entire sector's valuation was built on a shared hallucination.
Right. The whole sector was failing the test.
Right. When you price an asset based on its peers, you are implicitly assuming the broader market has priced those peers correctly. You're adopting whatever story the market is currently believing.
And when that macro narrative broke in 2000,
Cisco's multiple compressed violently. The stock fell over 80%.
Wow.
Being cheap relative to expensive offers absolutely zero margin of safety when the denominator of your entire industry collapses.
Okay, so if multiples just anchor us to these market-wide delusions, we're basically forced back to the DCF.
We are. It's the best tool we have.
But since we just established that a DCF is just a narrative, you know, a story wearing a trench coat of mathematics, we need to understand how the internal mechanics of that story actually function.
Let's break it down. When you build a DCF, you're essentially manipulating five core assumptions.
Starting with the total addressable market and how fast you can capture it. Revenue growth.
Yeah, that revenue growth assumption is the engine of the entire model. But where most narratives fall apart is the disconnect between that growth engine and the operational reality of the business. You know, the second assumption, operating margins.
Right, the company's competitive advantage.
Right. You frequently see analysts project aggressive revenue growth alongside expanding operating margins.
Which is just...
They're telling a story where a company rapidly scales its market share while simultaneously gaining massive pricing power.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because that defies basic business logic. If you're growing that aggressively, you usually have to slash prices to win market share or spend an absolute fortune on customer acquisition.
You can't usually do both simultaneously.
No. It reminds me of building a character in a role-playing video game.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you can max out your character speed and agility stats, but if you don't allocate any points to stamina, your character collapses the moment you try to sprint.
That's a perfect analogy.
A financial model has to have that same internal consistency. You can't model 30% year-over-year revenue growth without dramatically increasing your reinvestment assumptions.
Which is the third lever, right?
Exactly. Reinvestment requirements.
Yeah.
How much cash the company consumes to keep growing. And the capital expenditure required to sustain that growth is often the most neglected part of the story.
Especially for non-software companies. Right. A software company might scale highly efficiently, but if you're modeling an airline or a semiconductor manufacturer, they consume massive amounts of cash for every incremental dollar of revenue. If you model high growth, but low reinvestment there?
You're modeling a magical business that defies the laws of physics.
Exactly. It defies economics.
But even if you get the growth and the margins and the reinvestment aligned perfectly, the math still leaves room for massive manipulation when we get to the fourth lever, the discount rate.
Oh, the discount rate. The perceived risk of the cash flows. In practice, it frequently functions as a mathematical fudge factor.
A fudge factor.
Yeah. Because of the way exponential discounting works, tweaking your rate by just 1% can drastically alter the present value of distant cash flows.
Right. Because you're applying that rate across 10 whole years of projections. So if an analyst finishes their model and the valuation comes in, say, 20% lower than the current stock price,
they don't have to rethink their fundamental thesis.
They just shave a little off the discount rate. They argue the company's risk profile has magically improved, and boom, the math outputs the target price they wanted all along.
It is completely reverse engineering the inputs to justify a predetermined output.
That's terrifying.
It gets worse. The place where this mathematical distortion is most severe is the fifth lever, the terminal value.
What happens after this specific 5 to 10 year forecast period ends?
Right. When you run a standard DCF, you forecast the specific cash flows for a decade. But a company doesn't cease to exist in year 11.
We hope not, anyway.
Right, so analysts use formulas to calculate a terminal value, which represents the present value of all cash flows from year 11 into perpetuity.
And because you're assuming a company operates forever, that terminal value ends up being disproportionately huge, right?
Disproportionately huge is an understatement. The source notes that it regularly accounts for 60 to 80% of a company's entire valuation.
Wait, really? 60 to 80%?
Yes. The vast majority of the mathematical output of a DCF, this supposedly rigorous empirical tool, rests on a single, highly generalized assumption about what the world, the macroeconomy, and the competitive landscape will look like a decade or more from now.
That's wild.
It is the number that ultimately dictates the valuation, yet it is often the number that receives the least critical scrutiny.
So to summarize, we have this tool where 80% of the output is a literal guess about the distant future, and the risk metrics can be openly fudged to hit a target.
Yep, that's the DCF.
Now, let's look at what happens when we introduce AI into this workflow, because this is the central tension of the modern investor, right? The split between who computes and who narrates.
Exactly, the agent-human split.
If we outsource this entirely to an AI agent, we hit a major roadblock. I mean, agents are flawless at computation. They can instantly retrieve a decade of historical SEC filings.
They can structure the scenario mechanics perfectly in seconds.
But an agent doesn't actually have a worldview.
No, an AI has no genuine conviction about the future. It doesn't have a thesis on whether decentralized finance will disrupt traditional banking or if solid-state batteries will revolutionize EVs.
So when you ask it to project revenue growth and terminal value, it has to fill those cells with something.
And it inevitably defaults to Wall Street consensus.
It just scrapes the average analyst estimates from the web.
Exactly. But if the AI is just pulling Wall Street consensus, and Wall Street consensus is what drives the current market price,
then an AI valuation that perfectly matches the current stock price is just a mathematical echo chamber.
Pure circular logic. It hasn't verified the price through independent analysis or original research. It just took the narrative that created the market price, ran the math on it, and handed the market price back to you.
Wow. It just launders the average opinion.
And Damodaran highlights an even more insidious problem with agents here, which he calls discount rate blindness.
Okay, what is that?
So when an AI calculates that discount rate we discussed earlier, it typically defaults to using a metric called beta.
Okay, beta.
Which measures historical stock price volatility relative to the broader market. So if a stock hasn't been volatile over the last 3 years, it has a low beta.
Makes sense.
And the agent mechanically assigns it a low discount rate, implying it is a low-risk investment.
But historical price volatility and fundamental business risk are entirely different things.
Completely different.
Right. Because a legacy auto manufacturer might have had a perfectly stable stock price for the last 5 years, so the AI sees low volatility. But tomorrow, a breakthrough in autonomous driving or a flood of cheaper foreign EVs could completely destroy their business model.
Exactly. The historical stock chart is completely blind to technological disruption. The AI is mistaking the map for the territory. It equates historical price stability with future operational certainty.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
This is exactly why you cannot let an AI run a valuation end-to-end and blindly trust the output.
So what does this all mean for the listener? If the AI is just laundering Wall Street's average opinion to look like original research, how do we actually use it?
The workflow has to fundamentally change.
Right. You don't use the AI to give you the final answer. You use the AI to build the baseline default model of what the market currently believes.
Right. You establish the baseline.
And then you read those AI consensus assumptions like a fiction book. You actively hunt for the plot hole. You look for the specific narrative, whether it's the terminal growth rate or the margin expansion, that you believe the consensus is getting wrong.
And once you identify that load-bearing assumption, you perform what's called sensitivity analysis.
Oh, right.
You instruct the agent to hold everything else constant, but change that one specific variable to reflect your unique thesis, and you recompute the model.
Let the machine do the math based on your story.
Exactly. The delta between the consensus valuation and your adjusted valuation is your actual investment thesis. The agent handles the heavy mathematical lifting, but you provide the narrative conviction.
Which is incredibly empowering, but man, it introduces a massive psychological risk.
It really does.
Because if valuation is just a story, and we are the ones writing the story, human beings are phenomenal at telling ourselves fairy tales.
Oh, we are the best at deceiving ourselves.
Right. When a stock we own is down 30%, we are incredibly good at moving the goalposts. We adjust the narrative to justify holding on to a losing position. So how do we avoid that rationalization trap? How do we keep our stories grounded in reality?
Well, motivated reasoning is the investor's greatest enemy. Your brain will actively filter out information that contradicts your thesis, especially when real financial loss is on the line.
So what are the guardrails?
The source material outlines three specific guardrails to short-circuit that psychological trap. The first one is pre-commitment.
Pre-commitment. Okay, this is the idea of writing down your kill criteria before you ever deploy capital.
Exactly. If you don't define what failure looks like in advance, your brain will easily redefine failure as a temporary macroeconomic headwind once you're emotionally and financially invested.
Right. It's just a bump in the road.
It'll bounce back.
Right. So if your thesis relies on a company achieving a 20% market share, you explicitly document. If market share falls below 15% for two consecutive quarters, the narrative is broken and I will sell.
You are creating a binding contract with your future, more emotional self.
Yes. The second guardrail is inversion, which directly attacks confirmation bias.
Instead of asking your AI agent to validate your bull case,
you mandate that it construct a highly specific bear case.
And the specificity is key here, right? If the AI just outputs like, macroeconomic conditions might worsen or competition might increase, that's completely useless. That's just generic noise.
You have to force the agent to be tactical. You say, assume operating margins compress by 400 basis points over the next 2 years. Identify the specific competitor, launching which specific product, targeting which demographic that would cause that exact compression.
Oh, wow.
If you cannot look at a highly credible, mathematically sound bear case like that and still maintain your conviction, you don't actually understand the risk profile of the asset. That is so powerful.
Yeah.
I also love the third guardrail, which is the outsider test.
Yes, the outsider test.
You take the raw assumptions, just the growth rates, the margins, the reinvestment needs, without revealing the company name or the final valuation, and you present them to someone with absolutely zero skin in the game.
Right, a friend or a colleague.
But you aren't asking them to validate the math. You are monitoring your own physiological reaction when they poke holes in your story.
This is my favorite part. If they question your margin assumptions and your heart rate elevates, if you feel your face flush and you immediately go on the defensive,
you're rationalizing.
You have crossed the line from analysis into rationalization. You are no longer evaluating a business. You are defending your ego.
But, you know, even with all these psychological guardrails in place, a part of me wonders if we're just bringing a knife to a gunfight.
How do you mean?
Well, if the retail inventor is sitting at home with an LLM and some public SEC filings, they're competing against Wall Street institutions that have Bloomberg terminals, real-time credit default swap spreads, institutional order flows, satellite imagery of retail parking lots. I mean, are we fundamentally outgunned here?
If we connect this to the bigger picture.
Yes.
Yes, if you try to compete on information velocity, you will lose every single time. The institutional players will always have the data milliseconds before you do.
Right.
But the source material makes a crucial distinction. Your edge in the modern market with an AI agent is not informational.
Okay.
It is analytical and it is behavioral.
Because institutional investors are dealing with structural constraints that we just don't have. They're dealing with intense career risk.
Massive career risk. A portfolio manager often can't afford to deviate too far from the benchmark. If they bet against the consensus narrative and they're wrong, they lose their job and their clients.
Wow.
It is professionally much safer for them to fail conventionally alongside the herd than to be wrong unconventionally.
They are structurally forced into consensus, which creates immense market inefficiencies.
Exactly. Your advantage as an independent investor is the freedom to construct a more logically rigorous narrative, stress test it with AI without that institutional pressure, and most importantly, possess the behavioral discipline to abandon that narrative the second the fundamental data turns against you.
Without worrying about a quarterly performance review.
Precisely.
So the entire paradigm completely shifts for you as an investor. The heavy lifting of financial modeling, the endless spreadsheet formatting, the complex discounting calculations. There's a fully commoditized skill now. An AI agent can execute the math flawlessly in 3 seconds.
It's table stakes.
The rarest skill in modern investing is narrative intelligence. It's the absolute honesty to choose the right story, the rigor to stress test its internal logic, and the emotional fortitude to change your mind when the facts change and the plot holes become too big to ignore.
And, you know, if we take a step back, this leaves us with a really fascinating question about the broader market structure.
Let's hear it.
We discussed earlier how up to 80% of a company's active valuation is tied to the terminal value.
Right, that highly subjective guess about a decade from now.
It's literally a sci-fi story about the distant future. Active investors are constantly battling over whose narrative of the future is more accurate. But today, an ever-growing percentage of the stock market is controlled by passive index funds.
Right, funds that just buy the entire index indiscriminately, based purely on market cap.
They don't read the story, they don't calculate the math, they buy blindly. So as passive investing continues to dominate, these massive capital flows are indiscriminately reinforcing whatever narrative the active market has currently settled on, driving valuations even further away from the underlying mechanical realities of the businesses.
Oh my God.
We are rapidly moving toward a market where the majority of the money is completely detached from the narrative altogether. It's basically the collective, real-time rewriting of a sci-fi novel about the distant future, funded by passive capital.
Which makes the ability to independently verify the story more valuable than ever before. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you look at a stock ticker, a real estate appraisal, or even just a corporate budget, don't let the decimal points and the precision of the spreadsheet intimidate you. Look right past the math, find the load-bearing assumptions, and ask yourself the only question that actually matters. What story is this secretly telling? Catch you next time.